OT.
I'm Alan Beard, Chief Brand Officer of Otter Media. My background started in consumer market research at Jupiter Media Metrics. Spent 5 years working with media companies, thinking about what the internet was going to do to their businesses. And then I launched a creative agency called McBeard that grew, got acquired by Fullscreen. I became the CMO of Fullscreen. And then Otter Media acquired Fullscreen, and I became the chief brand officer at Otter Media. For those of you who don't know Otter, it is a next-generation media company. Rooster Teeth, Elation, which is Crunchyroll and Verve, investments in Hello Sunshine, Gunpowder and Sky, a great group of companies that I'll talk a little bit about today. But I want to spend the bulk of our time today thinking about fandoms, and I have a slide that Brandon's going to put up here for a second. Anyone who knows me knows that this is my favorite slide in the world. I've used this one slide in probably 10 different presentations to tell different stories, and so I'm going to quickly give you the bullets of the 10 different presentations I've used this for, and I have a challenge for you, which is you tell me what you would use this slide to tell when we're done. And because I don't have someone here to interrupt me and ask questions, I give you the permission to interrupt me and ask questions before the end if there's something you want to talk about. But I'm going to talk about fandoms, and especially today, media fandoms. And the typical way I talk about this slide is there was a time when I was a kid, it was a blissful time, there were three TV networks, and they had everything I needed. And in fact, they had something for everyone. That was in fact the model of the TV networks, something for everyone. So, and the programming on the three networks was remarkably similar, right? It was the news all had a little bit of sports and a little bit of weather and a little bit of international and a little bit of this. And you could look at, if you didn't see the branding and if you didn't know the names of the people on the newscast, you wouldn't know from one station to the next whose news show it was, whose sitcom it was, whose whatever it was. There was nothing specific in the tone of them that made people know inherently. I don't know if this remote is going to work from up here. Not if it's turned off. So this world we moved into after that is which I typically call the cable world, just when I'm giving broad media presentations, is we got a whole bunch more channels, and the channels kept growing, and they got more specific. They were dedicated news channels, dedicated sports channels, dedicated cooking channels, and you start to have these audience groupings based on things they're interested in. And that too was a controllable world. It was a world we understood. It was a world that was more fragmented, and we start to use that term fragmentation. But the world that we are in now and the world that we're headed into looks increasingly messy or beautiful, depending on how you look at it. It is a world where so many things fundamentally shift from the left side of this to the right side of this. So I want to talk through a few of those really quickly, and that's my challenge to you. If I gave you this slide to work into one of your presentations, what story does this tell? It's a media fragmentation slide, sure. It's an audience fragmentation slide, sure. It is. It tells a lot of different stories, but one, of course, is the networks going from three TV networks that encapsulated all viewership to 100, then 500 cable channels to now infinite choices of where to receive content. Right, and as the places you can get content grew exponentially, the power shifted to the right. At every step of this, the power shifts to the right. So networks had power, consumers have power. And not only that, you get this shift that is in a different way of telling this. I've talked about how on the left, you have, when you're doing something that's something for everyone, you have high communication between people about the things that they watched. That's water cooler talk, right? That's what we used to call it. And it's because you could go to work or to school or whatever, and you could say, hey, did you see that last night? And people would say, yes, I saw that last night. And it was that was common. There was something in common. We watched the same thing. That was what it was. But as you move across this to the right, it isn't did you watch the same thing. The assumption is, except in a few things that are truly giant, that you didn't watch the same thing. It is, when you're over here on the right, you know that in your small circle, that everyone saw the thing you saw. The question is not, did you see it? The question is, did you feel the same way about it that I felt about it? Right? And so as we look at this, we go from this, things were available and I saw them, to I saw the things that my group cares about, and here's how I felt about it. And people seek to find matches in these communities of not someone who saw the same thing that they saw. That's too easy. That's too broad. That's old. But people who feel the same way about the thing that they saw. People who enter a similar emotional state about the content that they're consuming, instead of just having a shared experience of having been in front of the same screen or the same show on the same thing. And so we go from a world of must-see TV, which the idea of it was, let's try to communicate to the whole audience that this is a can't-miss thing because people will be talking about this tomorrow, to something that maybe you'd call it must be or something. It's more identity driven. It's more about who this audience is and how small you can get. And now necessarily as you move across, the audiences are smaller, but like I said, with each small audience, you have a much deeper intensity of the emotional reactions to the content they're having. And so you have people who are invested in it. And I've been in this room all morning and been listening to the panelists. And it's a consistent theme across the morning. The Sandeep, the guy from Amazon Fire TV, talking about small audiences that they can recognize and going to seek partners and saying that, in fact, they need YouTube as a partner because that's what the consumer demands. They can't please a Fire TV audience if they say YouTube isn't important to us because we don't own it. In the same way, you have people who over here, they've found something that they care a lot about, and they want to connect with other people who care a lot about that thing, and it's okay if it's small. Some of these dots over here are just individuals with a following. Some of these are just creators on YouTube, and they have a bunch of fans. But even looking at this, if you go from three networks to however many cable networks, there are now 2,500 plus YouTubers that have more than 1 million subscribers. So, and if you add in the other social networks, you're talking about probably an order of magnitude at least of how many people have 1 million fans that follow the thing that they create. And so it's an exponentially fragmented universe, but it's a good thing in my opinion. Now, I'm not a TV programmer, so I understand that viewership numbers down and to the right is not what anybody wants. And yet, we're entering a time when, because of the emotional reaction to the smaller worlds, to these small groups that people can gather around and have, they feel like their people, their tribe, their audience, their kindred spirits care about this one thing. They're monetizing differently than traditional media audiences. And so for us, an example in this would be Rooster Teeth, a company that's part of our portfolio. They have every kind of monetization that you can have, and a super intense identity brand kind of following where people wear the shirts, they go to live events to meet other people who love the thing that they love, they subscribe to the SVOD, they go to the live events, they purchase games, they fund Kickstarter projects from the founders. They're deeply engaged across it. And so you have a 360 monetization of the fandom that comes not from trying to exploit the fandom, but from the fandom saying, we want more ways to be engaged with each other and with this company. And so it builds a different model. And the question for a lot of traditional media companies will be how to re-aggregate audiences on the other side. How do we find people who care about animation and tech and some of these worlds where there's creators and even small media companies that have passionate followings, but they aren't reaching massive audiences. How do we bring them together in something together and pull these audiences together so that there is a sense of community and a big enough audience that you can build great tech that serves that audience? That's what we're doing at Verve. And it's something that I think when you have companies that will invest in the tech infrastructure and the experiential part of building fandoms, that then IP creation, storytelling, traditional media has a way of becoming a part of people's lives and becoming profitable in a way that those small audiences now can't get to. Can we keep that slide up? The other thing that is interesting about it, and I allude to this in talking about the 360 monetization and fans expressing that they want more ways to monetize. When Tosca Musk was up here talking about Passion Flicks, she said something that I thought was interesting, which is that she was talking about the intensity of the romance novel audience, which. She was saying that the average book buyer buys one book every 6 months, but the fandoms of romance novels buy on average 5 books a month. And so she was looking at this audience that's underserved and going specifically after this audience, and she's seeing even in places internationally where they can't subscribe yet, they're paying in advance to support the community. This isn't normal. If Comcast or someone else ran an ad right now saying, "Hey, we're going to launch a service next year. It's going to be for you-ish. Give us $100 now, and a year from now, when the service launches, you'll have access to it." Literally, no one would do that. It is not something to do. But when you get over here to the right and you say, hey, this to an audience you've been serving, to an audience, to a community that you're a part of, and you say, hey, if we could, we would create this great experience for you. Is this something you would support? And give them the opportunity to support that. Then what you see over here in these smaller communities is people willing to write bigger checks, to pay up front for things, to get the ball rolling. At Otter, we call this consumer as sponsor. So we don't think of this as, on the left, a world controlled by gatekeepers who look at IP and think, can I go find an audience for this if I greenlight it? Instead, we're over here and we say, we have an audience, community members, what should we greenlight? And we're making those decisions based on real conversations and real interaction with the fans who would pay for it, instead of looking at the infrastructure we have and what type of scale we need to support that, and then greenlighting only the things that we think can be big enough to support the scale that we need over here. Now, sometimes it works. I'm a huge TV fan. I love Epic TV, and so I understand that to create something like Game of Thrones, that you have to have tens of millions of people who really want that, and to write that check up front to greenlight that, you have to imagine that you can have an audience that big. This is the advantage of HBO, of Netflix, of Amazon Prime, of anyone who has subscribers who are giving them data up front and paying them and saying, I will continue to pay for this as long as I can if you're creating this stuff that my data tells you that I love. Over here, it's a different game, right? The data is different. The data is more personal. You're talking about a smaller group of people, and I ask all the time, Arlen Marmelis here from Verve, and one of the things we think about all the time is, What is the minimum viable OTT? How small a group can you super serve and still have a chance at making money someday? Now, the answer is different now than it was 2 years ago. I expect that the answer will be different 2 years from now than it is now. But But that becomes the question over here in this multi-dot, mini-dot universe. That's M-A-N-Y dot, not M-I-N-I, although I guess both apply. And so this desire to serve something that has a deeper emotional connection over here and to live in the emotional side of this so that fans, instead of waiting for a gatekeeper to greenlight the thing they've always hoped would be made, the movie they hoped would be made, the series they hoped would be made, the comic book they hoped would be turned into to a series. Instead of that, they say, hey, this is something we would fund. This is something we want. Let's do this. With Crunchyroll, Kuhn, the founder of Crunchyroll, saw way ahead of the curve that anime was that the anime audience was, like Tosca described the romance novel audience, that there were people out there spending a lot of money on anime, and that there was an intense community there that didn't have access to all of the great content that existed elsewhere. And they made a very smart play in creating the go-to definitive brand in anime for fans of anime to have all access to the stuff that was available. And now it's shifting from that. They understand that they gathered that. They're looking now at the future and saying, how do we super serve this audience? How do we do even more for this fandom that we've gathered, for this group of people that cares not about us as a company, but about the stuff that they love? How do we be a partner with the fan to get more of this stuff that they want created, instead of how do we be gatekeepers that maximize value for the media company? And so it's a shift in how we think about the audience. And then, finally, the other conversation I've had with this is that really this also represents the end of generational marketing. And what I mean by generational marketing is thinking about audiences by how old they are. Right, so the demo 18 to 49 or whatever, however your industry defines demographic age groupings, it's really easy to bucket them in three. Right, but what we see now is that there's a much richer pool of data that tells us more important things about people than how old they are. And when you get into something that's identity media, something people are passionate about, it doesn't really matter how old they are or where they live. It matters what they care about, who they want to hang out with, where they're willing to spend their time and money, their limited resources, to be a part of it. And so we move from availability to love, from limited choice to infinite choice, and from passive viewership to active, engaged, sponsoring fans. And so that's my multi-take on this one slide. I'm interested to hear any of your questions about what we're doing at Otter, or even to tell me what you think this slide should represent, and I'll use that in my next presentation. Any questions? Yeah. You have to speak into the microphone.
I forgot
pillow.
The pillow. Or not. Is this okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So I am in several of those dots on the right. I'm an avid watcher of Twitch. I subscribe to multiple different channels. That's $5 a month for each.
Right.
I subscribe to YouTube Red, Netflix, Hulu. Do you see any sort of transition maybe back one level? Because from the customer perspective, I mean, it won't be sustainable to subscribe to everything individually.
Yeah, so I think there's two questions there, and I'll give two quick answers. One is that I do think that there is a reaggregation play for companies over here, finding similar dots and bringing them together under one value proposition. That is happening already. It arguably is already the Netflix model. They've got all of these dots are the individual shows, and they've gathered them all under a thing called Netflix. There isn't a Netflix kind of show. They're every kind of show. They're really serving small audiences within the giant audience. Second, I would say that I actually believe that people will spend more money on media consumption in the future to get less than they used to get. And so Do I think that there are people out there who seek value? Yes. We know from the data that there are people who cycle in and out of Hulu, in and out of Netflix. They binge for 30 days, and then they drop it, and then they come back. It's the bane of all acquisition marketers' existence. And yet, people do that because some people are value seekers. They want to get the maximum amount of content for the least amount of money. That's not what I'm talking about over here. I'm talking about people over here, like you, who are willing to pay $5 a month to support the Twitch streamer that you really like. And that doesn't actually follow a traditional pattern of consumption. When you spend $5 on a Twitch streamer, you're serving a different need that you have or a different desire you have than what you would expect for $5 from CBS. And because CBS creates content, they make it available, and you might be willing to pay $5 for it, but this Twitch streamer relies on you to pay $5 a month for them to keep doing the thing that they do in the way that they do it. And it says more about you and what you're supporting over here than it does about them and what value they're bringing to the mass audience, if that makes sense. That's part of what I mean by identity media. People who spend the media dollars based on who they think they are and what they want to stand for and who they want to support. We're done. I will be right out here if anyone wants to talk more about this. Thank you again.